Good evening, everybody. Welcome to Ancient Rome. Before we look at one of my very favorite plays of all Shakespeare, Antony and Cleopatra, just let me say a word about the exam, which is next week for those of you who are taking the course for credit. Some study guides are on the web, is this right, Mel? You should take advantage of looking at them. Again, the exam will be very straightforward. If you've been following the reading carefully, you should have no difficulty doing this, but look on the web and see, you know, what kind of guidance we're able to offer you. Exam will be in this room for those of you who are taking it in person, this is right, at 5:30, and it will last an hour in total. And there will be no other lecture next week. So for those of you who are, for all of you, those of you taking the course for credit and not for credit, you'll have a chance to digest your Shakespeare and come back refreshed and with a new set of questions for the following week, because the week after next is Coriolanus, so that we are able to return one more time to Shakespearean tragedy. And I might suggest, just looking forward 2 weeks, and maybe we can actually put this on the web as well, that when we talk about Coriolanus, we might take a moment to talk more broadly or generally about what we have seen in middle to late Shakespearean tragedy, that we might take out a 15 minutes or so to sort of try to bring things together. Are there questions about the exam or about the timetable? Yes. No, it's an hour-long exam. That's right. It's timed for an hour. It's timed for 15 minutes, I guess, really. But yes, that you'll be in the room for an hour, and then they will collect the exam. Yes, sir?
Can you tell us a little about the format of the exam? Short answer?
It's a short answer exam. One of the things that I just put up on the web this afternoon is an example exam from a past semester, and it will follow that format exactly. So you can see exactly seven passages. You'll choose five of them, and then five short answer questions from each of those passages.
Okay. And needless to say, it's a closed book exam. This is not an open book exam. So you're to use your memory and your insights. If you're looking at a passage and you don't remember where it comes from, you should be able, from some clues within the passage, to kind of figure out where it comes from. And to write about it, and to write about its significance. So, okay. Other questions about this? Okay. Yes.
To mention,
yes,
too, that papers went back to the extension school today and should have been in the mail today, so you'll all get those shortly.
Okay. Let me take this opportunity to thank both Nell and Larry for all the hard work that they're doing in this course. This is very much a collaborative effort, and it gives us great pleasure to do it. I also want to thank those of you who came last evening to the discussion of Macbeth, the all-female Macbeth production over at the Actors Shakespeare Project in BU. Those of you who got there by car will have coincided with the tribute band to Pink Floyd and therefore had to pay $25 to park, so I'm particularly grateful to you for coming. It was very nice to see many of you in the audience on that occasion. So here we are talking about Antony and Cleopatra, which is a play that we might think emerges very interestingly out of plays that had strong, complicated female characters like the older daughters in King Lear, or even the younger daughter in King Lear, and Lady Macbeth. There are some pathways that I'm going to suggest that we might follow in getting through this play, but before I do, I thought maybe since we've read enough plays together for you to have some sense of what interests you particularly, what puzzles you particularly, that I might start today by inviting some questions or some themes or some issues that you want us to discuss. So let's begin just by your letting me know, if you have them, some things that are particularly puzzling or fascinating to you. And I'm just going to list them, and then we'll try to deal with them as we can. Yes, sir?
Well, I've noticed in several of the plays we've been working on, and you've remarked on this, there's this sort of duality of locations. You have the civilization and you have the wild, you know, Venice and Cyprus and Othello, et cetera.
Right.
And I found that duality was especially evident in here with Greece and Egypt.
Right.
And particularly, and even to a certain point, represented in the characters of Anthony and Cleopatra. So I think it's
good. Okay. Roman Egypt. Good. Absolutely. Feels quite dark up here. Are there, is there a light that could illumine the situation? Let me see. I see. Okay. All right. I'll try to shine in other ways. Yes.
At the end of the lecture last week, you started, and then you were interrupted by the people coming in about the conclusion on Macbeth being a heroic, I think, in your words. I didn't quite understand your how one identifies with that as a hero. I mean, and but I mean, it's something that comes up. I mean, how much one identifies with characters who have a tragic flaw.
Okay. I don't remember actually talking about Macbeth as a hero, but I mean, what I would possibly have said is that he ends the play in a martial mode, that he, rather than despairing, that he wants to die with harness on his back, and then we get various narratives about him. But it's, let me take the second half of your questions, because it'll be more pertinent to what we want to talk about today, to talk about the identification. And I mean, I want to be a little careful about this notion of the so-called tragic flaw, since there is no such thing. It's a mistranslation of a misreading of Aristotle. And it's something that people get taught early on, and that it's very hard to get them to unthink, because it seems like it's a way into something. If you can name the flaw, I mean, so Othello is self-doubting, and Macbeth is ambitious, and so forth. But in fact, neither Shakespeare nor drama nor tragedy is so simple as that. And what's more characteristic of Aristotle is that notion that we get actually out of both Sophocles and Euripides, that character for mankind is fate, that how you are, that the world around you is a world that reflects your own character. But this notion of the hamartia, or the what's poorly translated as tragic flaw here, really has much more to do with a certain kind of disposition of personage than with something that is the one identifiable factor that turns you upside down. Nonetheless, we could certainly look at any character in these plays, and not only at the titular heroes and heroines, and say what kind of persona do they seem to have, where are their blind spots, where are their positions of confidence, and what changes about their own vision of themselves, or about our vision of them, during the course of the play. So I would like to urge you not to use the phrase tragic flaw, only because it suggests one singular trait, which is the undoing of a character, and I think that that's not in the spirit, actually, of Aristotle's Poetics. Having said that, certainly these characters make arcs through the play, and there are things that we often encounter about them quite early on that turn out to come back and reveal something about them. Talking about Macbeth last evening, I was struck again by how both the Weird Sisters and Lady Macbeth discuss him before he appears. And we'll see a similar situation in this play, in which you get various descriptions of Antony, and we get invited to see how much they do or don't match with the character that we see on stage, especially because the descriptions that we see are hyperbolic. They're heroic in the almost literal sense. They describe Octavius describes the Antony he once knew or once heard of, who was said to subsist on berries in the woods or in the mountains, and to drink the stale of horses, that is the urine of horses, that is to subsist in a very minimal way in the wild, not the luxurious life that Octavius imagines him to be living, and that we then see him to be living in Egypt, that his heroic Antony is an Antony who is extremely ascetic, is extremely martial, extremely disciplined, and offstage. The fabulous passage that we'll look at in Abarbus's description of Cleopatra, one of the most beautiful passages in all of Shakespeare, is a passage that begins with this fabulous view of her, the bard, she sat on like a burnished throne, burnt on the water, and so forth. It gives us this grandiose figure of, and it's very closely copied from the passage in Plutarch that describes this, of her on the water, tended by her boys who are like nereids and so forth, and it ends with her, with this counter image of her hopping through the street as to make defect perfection. We'll look at it, but it's somehow her flaw, if we like, that makes her seem even more perfect, more adorable. The one thing that she doesn't do perfectly makes her both incredibly human and incredibly divine at the same time. But this, too, is an image that is told by somebody. There are all these set pieces that describe both Antony and Cleopatra in the play. And then we are precisely invited, as an audience, to juxtapose those fabulous purple passages, in the case of the Enobarbus passage, literally purple, since their sails are purple, with those fabulous purple passages describing them with the characters whom we see, who are both more human-scaled and also more fallible and changeable. And with these characters, as with the play that we've read that this very much resembles, what's the other love tragedy that we read? Way, way back. Troilus and Cressida, yes, exactly. Troilus and Cressida, also a play about a pair of lovers who have a backstory in classical literature, in that case in the Iliad, and in the story of ancient Troy. Here we have the backstory in ancient Rome, and I'm going to talk about that a little bit too. But in both cases, they're being measured both against their heroic visions in the language of the play and the presuppositions we have about who these heroic figures are outside of the play. We saw that Troilus and Cressida was a very skeptical play, a play that took a good hard look at idealization of characters, whether it was Ajax or Ulysses or Achilles. Hector did remain heroic, but that's because he dies. But the lovers of Troilus and Cressida precisely pronounced, ironically, their own fates, as true as Troilus, as false as Cressida. And we saw that they were, to a certain extent, blindsided by the fact that we knew all about them before we met them, even though they didn't know that we knew. And here you could compare that play, if I can just digress for a second, to a very contemporary play like Stoppard's Rosencrantz and Guildenstern Are Dead, where, again, the audience knows all about Rosencrantz and Guildenstern, but you watch them within the text of this contemporary play trying to figure out what it means to be Rosencrantz and Guildenstern and trying to figure out who this Hamlet person is. It's a very similar structure where they're struggling against a kind of mythic identity that has been scripted for them, where they're the only ones in the dark about how the narrative is going to play itself out. So this is the third of these love tragedies that we have. No, this semester we haven't looked at Romeo and Juliet, but that would be the original starting point here. These three plays with the names of lovers intertwined, Romeo and Juliet, Troilus and Cressida, Antony and Cleopatra, and of course the stage keeps getting bigger and bigger and bigger. So with Antony and Cleopatra, they are huge mythic figures. If the Antony imagined by Octavius is heroic, the Antony imagined by Cleopatra is mythic in a classic Greek mythological sense, and they will, you know, literally divide the world among them, so the scope keeps getting larger and larger, even as also the lovers keep getting older and older. It's interesting what Shakespeare does with Cleopatra. Your footnotes will have told you probably something about the age of the historical Cleopatra at this time. Anybody happen to notice this in the footnotes? 29. Not in the Arden, she isn't. No. Not in the Arden, she's not. Not in this text. She's not. She's 29.
Oh, in Norton she's 29, definitely. Or 38.
In the Norton?
Yes. Ah.
Yes.
The Norton says that in actuality she's 29,
that's
but
right.
That Shakespeare makes her 38. That,
yes, exactly, exactly. There you go. There you go. The historical Cleopatra, not the literary Cleopatra, was 29. She, in this play, there's a wrinkle deep in time. What are some of the other phrases that are used about her that seem to suggest her age? The serpent of old Nile. There's that wonderful encounter with the messenger when the messenger shows up to tell her about Octavia. And Octavia is a widow, not a very good thing to be. Of course, Cleopatra, never mind all the men she's had in her life. She's small of stature and so forth. And then the messenger is trying to feed her all the lines that are going to make her approve of him and maybe tip him and so forth. And he says, and I do think she's 30. And you're meant to think, I believe, in the play, that Cleopatra says nothing because, in fact, she herself is older than 30. So that the idea that to the messenger 30 is old is not welcome information to Cleopatra. So the question that arises for a critic is, why should it be that the playwright takes a piece of historical information and changes it, as we see him do very frequently when he uses historical information, but why should he make Cleopatra older than the age that she was? Presumably a princess of Egypt could well have married and had lovers and so in this time period in her teens, so that it's not surprising that she would have had Pompey as a lover and so forth and still be 29. But it doesn't produce the dramatic effect of her being somehow incredible. This is the Gloria Swanson, Elizabeth Taylor, the description, really, the opening descriptions of Cleopatra very much set the stage for contemporary stardom. They precisely describe her changeableness, her fickleness, her attractiveness because she's this way, the fact that she is unpredictable, that everybody adores her, that you can't rely on her. It's a kind of template for the inconsistencies that go into the contemporary notion of a prima donna and a star. And they're all described here. You might well think or not think that these would be descriptions of Queen Elizabeth at the time. No age has a monopoly on these kinds of characteristics. But the fact that she's established as older pairs her with the older Antony as well. How do we know that he's older? Yes.
He's always referred to as being of a different generation by Octavius and by the other people.
We have to ask you to say it again into the microphone. I'm sorry.
He is often, the comments about Antony often referred to him as being of a different generation, of an older generation. For example, when Octavius speaks about him, they say that he belongs to an older generation.
Yeah, absolutely. There's a sense of a younger and older generation, of a change, of a fall, this notion of the heroic generation. This is the greatest generation. The greatest generation is passing, and it's being replaced by this guy often called boy, the Octavius Caesar. Whereas Antony will say at one point, though gray be somewhat mingled with our brown, there are verbal notes that want to emphasize the fact, it's not only the fact that there are people who are younger than he and talk about what he was like when he was a hero, but there's also a kind of insistence here that this is an older generation. Now this will match with the fact that the main players in Shakespeare's company are also aging. And the guy who played Romeo is likely to be the same guy who plays Antony. But it also gives you some sense of where the world is at this time. Because the younger generation here, the rising generation, measures itself against and fails to compete with the generation that is retiring or dying. And moreover, that generation itself exists on the stage if not in shrunken form, then at least in a form that is more recognizably human-scaled than the backstory that surrounds them. So if you want to imagine just for a second that you have a movie theater, and that on the movie theater is this great huge figure of Antony or Cleopatra, and then in front of it is the actor who plays Antony or Cleopatra, they look smaller by contrast with this huge image, which is the image of their own projection by history, by the people who were in love with them, by the people who were their rivals, by the people who heard their story, and so forth, even though they're actually normal sized. They're not diminished except by reflection of their own back image. This is what I'm trying still to speak to, this question about how we measure heroism per se, both on the Shakespearean stage and in the Shakespearean text. Because on the stage, you have a situation in which the actor could be quite close to the audience, in which you would, and they're speaking without amplification, in big booming voices, but still they're very recognizably human-sized and human-shaped. And this is a play which is very much concerned with this question of changing generations, change of times, the nostalgia for the old heroic moment, and the alternative to that old heroic moment. And here, just to go back to your question about Macbeth, at the end of this play too, there's an attempt on the part of the surviving heroic figure, who is that? At the end of the play, who of these lovers, who's alive in Act 5? Cleopatra. She's alone in Act 5 through this series of deceptions that have led to his suicide. And she also outsmarts the idea that she can be controlled, that she too will die with harness on her back, so to speak. She stages her own death. She performs her own death with the pretty worm of Nilus, with these asps in a basket that she nurses as if they were babies rather than poisonous snakes. What is the fate that she does not want to have? We have to deal with this machine.
She doesn't want to be brought back to Rome as in chains, so to speak, to be looked at as some prize that they won.
That's right. She doesn't want to be produced as a trophy, exactly, as part of a triumphal march. And also she doesn't want to be produced on stage to watch some squeaking Cleopatra boy my greatness in the posture of a whore. And, of course, this is the great tour de force of this play. We saw in King Lear that the great tour de force of that play was presumably the leap off Dover Cliff, in which Gloucester leaps upright and on a flat stage, and we have that feeling of the sublime instead of the ridiculous. In this case, it is, of course, a boy actor playing the part of Cleopatra who dares to say to us that she does not want to see some diminished, squeaking Cleopatra, that is, with a high voice that hasn't changed yet, boy my greatness, in the posture of a whore. I mean, this is a tremendous dare on the part of a dramatist at absolutely the height of his powers. That once again, as with the fall of Gloucester, you don't look at that and say, but it is a boy, but it is a squeaky voice. Instead, you think, well, this is really a tremendous triumph. She's taking her fate into her own hands and into her own theatricality. And this is the only sense in which I mean to say that at the ends of these plays, these characters are heroic. That is to say, that they restage themselves to us theatrically in a moment that recuperates from a moment of loss of darkness. From in the case of Macbeth, the tomorrow and tomorrow and tomorrow moment, the death of Lady Macbeth and so forth, there's a sense in which he pulls himself together. He doesn't redeem himself in any... what do I want to say? Transcendent way, but there's a moment in which the character reperforms what was his strong suit at the beginning. And with Cleopatra, very similar, that she begins the play playfully, indeed staging little scenarios, whether it's the fishing or the dancing or the pretending to be sad when she's not sad and so forth. If he is sad, say, I'm dancing. If in Mirth, say, I am sudden sick, the idea that she's going to jerk him around by playing games with him, which seems completely trivial and, we may say, charming, at the beginning of the play, turns into something that is far more sublime and profound, and where this notion of dying, which underscores the entirety of the play, I am dying, Egypt dying, is founded once again on that well-known Elizabethan pun on dying meaning to have a sexual orgasm and dying meaning to cease to exist. That these are our lovers who die together from the beginning to the end of the play, and they perform, they unpack, they unmetaphor that metaphor of dying as dying. And they do so in a way that moves it way beyond the level of pun or wordplay, that moves it really in a different direction. Please.
I love the clown's line to take your pleasure of the snake.
Yes.
Because that's so rich.
I wish you all joy of the worm. Yes.
Yes.
Yes. Exactly. And he says, but be careful because his biting is immortal. And again, this is one of these clowns that we encounter all over Shakespeare, like Elbow, the constable, and so forth, who speak in malapropisms, who say, remember Elbow, who's saying that his wife was disrespected, he wanted to be a disrespected woman rather than a respected woman, and who get the words backward. In this case, too, he means mortal, he means deadly to you. But he says immortal instead of mortal, and so we get both messages at once. We get the warning, and we get the lesson that he doesn't learn, but that we do learn, and that the biting of the snake does make her immortal, because it turns her into the Cleopatra of history, of fame, and of this play. And again, very characteristic of Shakespeare, who at this point knows exactly how to handle the theater, to punctuate this moment with a clown, with a low character, with a country fellow bringing this the snakes in a basket, rather than her other companions from the court, we suddenly have somebody from a different realm altogether. We started at the end, uncharacteristically. We should probably move back to the beginning, and we haven't got very far in our list of issues that are fascinating you in this play. Please.
I'm interested in the ideas of fidelity and betrayal.
Okay. And this presumably incorporates this question of to whom? I mean, whether it's fidelity to country or fidelity to... I mean, he's torn between different modes of fidelity. And her art form is betrayal. That's what she is able to do so seductively that it's like a come on for him. But good, all right, this is a good topic for us. Anything else that you want to mark for us at the beginning, wherever we are?
How the public person impinges on the private person and vice versa.
Okay, great. I'm going to write these three words down in a row, because I want to remind us that the word person is built on the word persona, which means mask. That this is the Greek word persona, so that a person is also a self-impersonation. That just as we said that things like gender on the stage or rank on the stage are all simulated, these are not emperors or empresses, these are not nobles, these are not Romans, and these are not women, so also what a person is within these plays is a self-constructed fiction, is a mask that is assumed. There is, in a way, no reality to these. These are all self-presentations. And even a soliloquy, even a monologue, confronts the self-constructor with his or her self-construction, or with the doubts or holes within that self-construction. So the public-private person, and indeed the public-private persona. And there was at least one more hand I saw. Yes, back here, please. Mel, right behind you, please. Okay, good.
I was interested by the issue of power and women, mm-hmm. which shows up everywhere, but it shows up a little differently here. In some respects, it shows up the same when you look at Octavia. It seems that she's treated the same way as Cressida or many others. She's just
or maybe
told
Lady
what to
Macduff.
Do. or Lady Macduff.
Right.
But you look at Cleopatra and things change radically.
Okay. Who are some of the women we... So, Octavia. Okay, who else? We've talked about Cleopatra. We'll put her down here. What else? No, sorry, in this play. In this play. Fulvia. Let's not forget Fulvia. Okay. And then there are Cleopatra's ladies, Charmian and Iris. Iris. Okay. Okay. Yeah.
Yeah, duty, loyalty, and I don't know what the sensuousness, which comes out so much in the play, but where that comes in, because part of that's sort of egotism, I suppose, which is the opposite of duty.
So what is the opposite of duty? Pleasure. Pleasure.
Sensuousness, pleasure, all that
pleasure.
Stuff which
the,
comes out.
This play works very much on this question of pleasure and virtue. And this the question of whether pleasure could be reconciled with virtue is a big issue for this time period. This is the famous choice of Hercules, the choice between pleasure and virtue. And you may remember that Antony has a tutelary spirit who is the god Hercules, and that he is imagined in many ways as a kind of personation of the figure of Hercules, including the fact that Hercules at one point was enslaved by an Amazon queen, by a dominating woman who dressed him in women's clothes and set him to spinning. Now, we don't actually see Antony in women's clothes, but we do see him described as emasculated or under the control of Cleopatra. Interestingly, the word effeminate in the English Renaissance did not mean having stereotypical characteristics of a certain kind of homosexuality, as it might today, but instead meant the opposite, under the sway of women, too attached to women. To be effeminate was to be feminated, you know, controlled by women. And in this case, that seems to be what has happened to him. And he sees the choice that lies before him. In the East, my pleasure lies, he says. He's torn between Rome and Egypt, which become for him, among other things, these poles of duty and pleasure, or virtue and pleasure. And, of course, the characters map onto this as well. Who are the characters who would map onto pleasure for him? In the East, my pleasure lies. So where is Cleopatra? Yes. And where would his duty lie then? With Octavia, yes. And who is Octavia? She's the sister of Octavius Caesar. As whenever you get brothers and sisters, or brothers and brothers, or sisters and sisters, or cousins of the same age in these plays, we're invited to see them partly as versions of one another. Certainly in the marriage scene, in which Octavius stands in for his sister, we see very vividly the idea that this political marriage, not an unexpected thing in this time period at all. People married all the time for dynastic reasons. Henry VIII married several women who he never saw except by looking at their portraits. And one of his rejection of Anne of Cleves was in part because he didn't think she resembled her portrait and had felt he had been betrayed by the image that had been sent in advance of her. But the idea of a dynastic marriage rather than a love match is very characteristic in this period, and not only among kings and queens. But in this case, the marriage is really an explicit political bargain between Antony and Octavius. And Octavia is caught in the middle. So that this little sketch that we're beginning to create about the kind of the sliding scale of where women are on this places her squarely in the line of duty or obligation or Rome, if you like. And she is from Rome, and she is the sister of the man who is now about to be in control of Rome. The fact that the play presents Antony in this classic choice, which would have for the English Renaissance been very legible as this kind of classic choice between virtue and pleasure, or between duty and sensuousness, as you say, shows you again something of the incredible resonances of this play, how many stories are told in one, in it, how much the classical background is felt. Because remember that this is, and I said this about Troilus and Cressida, but let me say it again, just to underscore it for you, that one of the reasons that this period is, you know, was at least in the last century, called the Renaissance, is because it was the moment of a so-called rebirth of classical learning, that there's a rediscovery of the ancient Greek and Roman classics, that people are taught them in school, that Shakespeare, we think, was taught them at the Stratford Grammar School, that the Aeneid of Virgil, we've seen already to be all over these plays, classically in Hamlet, also here. The modeling yourself after these classic heroes also was a key tenet of Plutarch's parallel lives of the Greeks and Romans, which was translated by Sir Thomas North in 1584. What Plutarch's lives is exactly is sort of, you know, a modeling of one hero against another hero. One from the Greek pantheon, and when I say pantheon, these are historical figures, not only mythological figures, and one from Roman history. And the implicit invitation to the Elizabethans and the Jacobeans, to the readers of North's Plutarch under Elizabeth and under James, was to supply the possibility of a third one from your own society, from your own civilization. If you have the ancient hero of Greece and the ancient hero of Rome, who is the modern one? The modern one in this case being the early modern, the one of Shakespeare's own time. So that he's, in a way, counting on your being familiar with this comparative historical way of thinking, counting also on your having some familiarity, more perhaps than today's undergraduates ordinarily do, with the Iliad, with the Aeneid, with some of these classical heroes and their characteristics. So this the tension that you rightly point out here is a tension which would have been felt mythically and historically as well as characterologically between and among characters. This is a play that situates itself among different time periods and also among Shakespeare's own plays at a moment when one could read sideways through Shakespeare as well as backward through history, that you could certainly remember Troilus and Cressida, that you could certainly, if you wanted to, remember Romeo and Juliet. What other plays that we've looked at, or what other moments in plays that we've looked at, seem to be sampled or remembered in this play?
Julius Caesar is referred to many times. The Battle of Pharsalia, Cleopatra's relationship with him.
Now, this is the historical story of Julius Caesar, but of course, Cleopatra herself doesn't appear in Shakespeare's play called Julius Caesar.
Oh, that's right. The death of Brutus. Maybe three or four allusions to events in the play.
Where do you find an allusion to the death of Brutus?
I think Antony reminisces mm-hmm. about what happened in the battles against the conspirators.
Right. Okay, I want to distinguish between a citation of something in the play and an analogy that we might make between something that happens in one play and something that happens in another play. So here, absolutely, you're right, that Julius Caesar looms over this whole play as a mythic presence and a mythic absence. Because what was his relationship to Cleopatra? They were lovers, or at least we're told. I mean, this famous story about his carrying her in a certain queen in a mattress, that Antony, too, is a son as well as a father. Antony, too, has a heroic history that he's trying to live up to. One of the things about Cleopatra is that she's been with so many heroical men that it's hard to keep up with her, and it's hard for these men to feel that they are her match. Please, go ahead.
I felt that there was a really strong relationship with Julius, with the play Julius Caesar, Shakespeare has just, this is an important image or pattern that the audience would be very familiar with, and that he would, I guess he wants to compare Antony with.
Well, certainly Antony makes the comparison. Whether, I'm trying to think, I mean, we haven't read Julius Caesar in here, so maybe it's not immediately a direct collective information, but obviously the so-called Roman plays that Shakespeare writes, he writes Julius Caesar, he writes Coriolanus, he writes Antony and Cleopatra. And one thing to be said about that structure is that in terms of historical time, Coriolanus is at the very, very beginning of the founding of the Roman Republic. Caesar is at sort of the notional high point of its glory. And then we see emerging out of the play Julius Caesar this figure of Antony, who revels long a nights, who is the very same figure whom we're going to encounter in this play, or a very similar figure, only younger, whom we're going to encounter in this play. Who is presiding over something like the end of a moment, but it's also the beginning, of course, of the Augustan era, of the time of Augustus Caesar, who is Octavius Caesar, and the dawn here of the Augustan age at the end of this play, which is also not incidentally the time of the birth of Christ. So you have at the end of this play a real change of epics, so to speak. But there is a nostalgia, I agree with you, for the real hero, Julius Caesar, who was the great lover, the playful lover and the powerful, masterful lover, and who was also the great hero, the great general, the one toward whom even Antony looks with admiration. I think that's very right. Yes?
You mentioned analogies. The thing that comes to my mind is the relationship between Cleopatra and Antony, as it parallels, in some ways, the relationship between Macbeth and Lady Macbeth, mm-hmm. in that Cleopatra seems to seduce Antony to a darker, certainly more erotic lifestyle, or the antithesis of Roman living, whereas Lady Macbeth is luring Macbeth away from a life of what might be called honor into a life of ambition and corruption.
So you see Antony and Cleopatra and indeed Macbeth and Lady Macbeth as having, so to speak, different agendas, where the female character is able to persuade him to abandon duty, let us say, for pleasure. How much of a struggle is it for Antony?
No, it doesn't seem to be much of a struggle at all.
At this point, it doesn't seem to be much of a struggle at all. Yes, please.
I had thought you were comparing in some way different plays.
I was asking you too.
Okay,
yes.
All right. Uh-huh. So I see Octavius Caesar really much like the Duke in terms of trying to, consolidate power, correct rules and regulations and how things work.
The Duke in Measure for Measure.
Yeah. This is like a more powerful description. I mean, you have countries involved.
Uh-huh. I'm wondering whether you think that Octavius's personality is like that of the Duke in Measure for Measure. What can we say about Octavius as a dramatic character?
He really is a very dry kind of person. Is it? He doesn't drink. I think he's older than he actually is in the play. He's described as a younger man in the play, I think.
And do you mean that he's actually in the play older than they call
younger,
him?
Younger, I thought.
Younger than the historical?
Actually, yeah. Okay.
Right. I don't have any idea how old the historical Octavius is, but I think it's right to say that he is here presented as callow, as young, as inexperienced, as full of ambition, as abstemious to a fault, as extremely resistant to, I was going to say phobic about, but maybe that's too strong, resistant to the licentiousness that he encounters or imagines in the Egyptian court. And it's playfulness. I mean, there's, as you say, something about him, which I don't exactly entirely see in the Duke, who, after all, is able to play peekaboo with the provost and, you know, make jokes with him and so forth. There are moments with the Duke in Measure for Measure where he does seem to have more more control of the aspects of his personality than Octavius. Yes, Bajie, please.
Analogies. Language, words are not always to be trusted. Lear's daughters, in what they said, were not to be trusted. Iago's words about Desdemona were not to be trusted. The witch's words in Macbeth were not to be trusted. And Cleopatra's message to Antony, uh-huh, which was not to be trusted.
Good, good, okay. And as in all of those instances, and as you're very right to point to them, I think, or it's very helpful that you should point to them, again, this is very characteristic of how Shakespeare builds a play. Something will happen that seems to be trivial, and then it will happen again. It will carry a huge amount of import. So that the playfulness, her use of contrariness for its own sake with him, you know, if he's sad Sam dancing and so forth, at the beginning of the play, doesn't mean anything. It's just play. It's just kind of sexy play. At the end of the play, what's the message that he gets that is a lie? She's dead. And this is no longer recuperable. It leads to his Roman suicide, to his dying on a sword, and here one does have the remembrance of Brutus's suicide, therefore leaves her alone in the last scene. So that this, again, very characteristic of Shakespeare, that one would see this, as one does almost always, even in these tragedies, that the first time you see these things, they don't carry all the import that they will subsequently. Okay. Let me just see what we have here. What I see is that we have a lot of dualities on the board. We have a lot of things that seem to be pairs of things, things that seem to be opposites to one another, whether it's pleasure and duty, or it's public and private, or it's fidelity and betrayal. How clear-cut are these distinctions in the play? How securely can we assign something to one or another side of that, of those binaries? Or let me put it a slightly different way. When I used to teach this course to my undergraduates years ago, I would use it as a way of testing the political temperature. And I asked them, and I'll ask you, how many of them identified as Romans and how many of them identified as Egyptians? You can probably guess the decades in which the Egyptians outnumbered the Romans and the decades in which the Romans outnumbered the Egyptians. How many of you, if forced to identify or to choose or to take sides, would side with the Romans? Hands high, please, so we can all see. And with the Egyptians. Okay, is anybody who didn't raise a hand? Anybody didn't raise a hand? Okay. Romans, say why. Yes.
Well, my main reaction to the play was shaped at the beginning by the spectacle of Antony's incredible inconsistency. In the first two scenes, he reverses himself. First, he says, "Let Roman Tiber melt," and
right.
Then he says,
"Here is my space." Right.
Uh-huh. I have to break these strong Egyptian fetters.
Exactly. Or lose myself in dotage. Exactly.
Uh-huh. And then that happens again when he takes Octavia. He makes the deal with Octavian, and then to marry his sister. And then he says, "In the East, my pleasure lies."
Right.
In the very next scene. And then after the two battles
at both Actium and in Alexandria, he rejects Cleopatra virulently and then reverses himself. And so the specter of Antony's inconsistency, of his un-Roman side, makes me, I find so painful that I militate, and I gravitate and, to the Roman side that he rejects.
Because you think Egypt is doing bad things to him?
Whatever is working in him, it is so painful to contemplate that I want to go to the extreme from which he is seems to be running occasionally.
Okay. There's no right answer. There's no wrong. I mean, this play is about the tug of war here. Antony is smack in the middle of it. It is the division within him that though I make this marriage for my peace, in the East my pleasure lies. This strong, you're quite right, that you cited all the right lines, this strong Egyptian fetters I must break or lose myself in dotage. But he loves his dotage in a way. He's later is described by his soldiers as being like a doting mallard following her ships when they leave the battle.
Flagrant, and it seems unusual, even in Shakespeare, that time and again, someone who is presented as a hero is shown to be so incredibly inconsistent. It's almost unbearable.
Is it fair to say that the Egyptian side might say that you are not giving a lot of power to love here? I mean, if we look at the private public here, does somebody want to defend the Antony who vacillates, who precisely goes back and forth? Back here, please.
He's totally smitten, and he's in incredible conflict, and he's besotted, and he's beside himself because he's besotted, and I'm on the side of love.
When he doesn't, I mean, he's conscious enough of this situation not to respect himself for this, but he can't help it. And the play ultimately will come down on the side of this transcendence, the folly leading to something that succeeds rather than something that fails.
But it leads to death. His love leads to death. Their love leads to death.
But that's not the worst thing. That's not the worst thing in the play, because you've got Octavius at the very end of the play trying to talk about this, the happy day and the end of the and moving forward and so forth. And you think about a world without Antony and Cleopatra in it, and you really don't so much want to see the play called Octavius, even though, in fact, if there were a play about Augustus, it would be a very interesting play. But the question, Dryden, when he rewrote this play at the end of the 19th century, called it All for Love, and picked up this question of what it means to give up the whole world for love.
It would seem that the double entendre of death is right there. So love leads to death, the death
right.
and the death.
Right.
And that's what they chose.
They choose it.
They choose it,
and right. they do it to themselves.
Right.
And they do it while thinking of the other one.
Mm-hmm.
He in despair, and she in a kind of triumph. I am dying, Egypt dying, he says as he kills himself. And she says, Antony, I come. There's that moment in which they reenact through their physical self-mortifications this act of the other kind of love. So that there's no easy path through this. It's clear that there's a certain dereliction of duty on his part. It's clear that he feels it. It's clear that Octavius feels. Rome needs him, and where is this hero now? So what's put in the balance is this question of whether it is ever plausible to, or whether it's possible to do this, or whether it's impossible not to do it. And so you have what in Greek is called a psychomachia, a struggle of the soul, going on inside Antony. And he talks about it all the time. And he doesn't hide from himself the degree to which what he's losing is himself. The whole business about looking at the cloud that's dragonish and so forth. That he feels as if he has no shape. That he has been unshaped, unmade by this. Yes, please.
I think you can connect this back to Julius Caesar, the final scene when Antony finds the dead Brutus. He calls him the noblest Roman of them all.
Right.
And Antony, in himself, thinks he may not be such a noble Roman.
Again, nobility, I mean, this question of nobility isn't so much an issue in this play. I mean, it isn't, I mean, I'm trying to remember a line in which it appears, but this is the values at issue in this play are somewhat different values. But they do have really to do with this question of whether a choice is ever possible to be made. Larry, yes, please.
I wanted to say this a couple minutes ago, but I side with the Egyptians because I feel like the primary problem with all of this situation is environment, and that Antony's in an environment that doesn't support him going over to love. And I feel like if he had the support to cross over from power to love, that maybe some of the conflicts that came up wouldn't have happened. But from the beginning, there's resistance to him being there. So,
what do you mean by environment? Do you mean his friends?
Well, he's a Roman, so the Roman, you know, Octavius, the Caesar, all the comments that they make about him, and the people talking about him in the very first scene, and all the talk about him from people who are around him is always negative about what's happening to him.
Well, we'll end in a second and then come back. But you're quite right to say that the very first word in the play is no. Nay, but this dotage of our generals o'erflows the measure. And this notion of overflowing banks, like the Nile River and so forth, this idea of not being contained, of not being a kind of classic closed structure, effeminizes him, again, makes him more like the superbly generative Cleopatra who has all these children and who is like the Nile and so forth. Those his goodly eyes that o'er the files and musters of the war have glowed like plated Mars, once he was just like Mars in armor, now bend, now turn, the office and devotion of their view upon a tawny front, that is a brown forehead, front is forehead here, his captain's heart reneges all temper and is become the bellows and the fan to cool a gypsy's lust. And the thing about a bellows is that it blows cool air in order to increase flames. And this is the paradox that we have in Antony from the very beginning. But again, the structure of the play, you're absolutely right, begins with these various characterizations of him in the negative or against what he used to be like. One of the opportunities for the audience is to see this as a positive description as well as a negative description. But certainly the Romans see it that way, see it in a negative way. We have to stop now. We'll return in 5 minutes. Thank you. Okay, so welcome back to Rome or Egypt, depending upon your choice. We have a question down here.
Well, I was thinking about this choice that you had us make a few minutes ago and how when you initially offered it up, I was thinking, I won't raise my hand. I don't want to be in either one of these camps.
Mm-hmm.
Then I finally raised my hand for the Egyptian camp. But I didn't really know why, except, love is all we need and all of that, and that seems to be, what's going on there. But then I thought, as other people were speaking, that the thing that really is drawing me to that side rather painfully is that I've made on a small scale the kind of mistakes Antony makes on a big scale. And so it's his weaknesses that attract me as a person, and by the same token, those weaknesses also make me want to say I don't want to be a part of that group.
I think this is actually a very interesting thing to say, maybe interesting on the biographical side as well, but on the analytic side, that the Shakespearean tragedy intersects the main characters at various moments in their development around the crisis, whatever it is. That Lear falls quite quickly, and then we see the consequences of his action throughout the whole play. Othello It takes a long time for the break to happen with him, and then he acts very quickly. In this case, you see a character for whom none of this is news, really, where you have his interiority and his interior struggle spread out in front of you for most of the play. He's already belated when the play begins. We're going to look at a couple of those passages because they're so beautiful. And we started to just before the break. The way people talk about him, almost as if he were dead. He was this like this, and he isn't like this anymore, and we need somebody to be like this. But he's there, and he's inhabiting these struggles. And he verbalizes them, and he does go back and forth and so forth. And he is, I think, a figure of tremendous interest because of that, because we have his... we have all his exploits. We don't see them, really. They are part of the information that we receive about him. Her exotic conquests, we also hear about in the background. We see her flirting with whom? With a messenger and then with a schoolmaster. We have very much this sense of a come down from the time when she was Pompey's plaything or Caesar's girlfriend. That you see them dealing with their own reduction, which is paradoxically, but crucially for this play, also their own greatness. That's where it comes from. It comes from being in touch with their own incapacities and their own failings and their own passions and going with them rather than against them. So that it's not an object lesson about sort of don't be an Antony. That's, you know, it might be that Octavius at a certain moment felt that that was what one would draw out of this, but he is present in a way as the observer who doesn't see, as in the kind of purloined letter structure, as the one who doesn't see what's really going on. I want, before we come to look at the text of the play closely, which I want to do for a little bit just because it's so magnificent, I just want to go back to this business about women and power for a second, because again, it's the one thing to say about the Egyptian world and the Roman world is that the Roman world is law and duty. It's also mostly men. If the Egyptian world is play and nighttime and sex and drink and games and so forth, it's also mostly women and eunuchs, men who have been physically castrated so as to be attendants for these women. The wonderful speech by Mardian the eunuch in which he says that the eunuchs too have their desires. That it's not, again, it's the desire and performance are not the same thing. He absolutely finds her as irresistible as everybody else. He's just unable to do anything about it, or so he says. But within the Roman world, you also have women. And the difference between Fulvia and Octavia was something that I wanted just to underscore for you before we come and we look at some of the passages. Because we have the succession of lovers in Cleopatra's life, but we also have some wives in the life of Antony. And I wonder if you can tell me, other than the historical fact of there being an Fulvia and then an Octavia in his life, what the difference between Fulvia and Octavia for Antony is. Tell me something about Fulvia.
In battles, doesn't she?
Yes,
Fulvia,
she does.
Thy wife first came into the field.
Uh-huh.
So she seems to be much more assertive and aggressive, sure of herself as a personality, whereas Octavia seems to be willing or not a pawn of the powerful forces.
Do we ever meet Fulvia?
Mm-hmm. No, she dies before.
No. She. We hear about her, that she's in the field, that she's indeed dressed in martial dress. Yes.
She does what she wants to do in battle. She didn't consult with him, as I understood it.
Right. So she is the what in Elizabeth's day was called the androgynous martial maiden. Only she's a wife, but she's the woman. If we talk about Lady Macbeth here, this is the figure who takes on some of the attribute the stereotypical attributes of the male warrior. And he admires her too. The news of her death then turns into this funny conversation with Cleopatra. Fulvia is dead. Dead? What? You know, you really admire Fulvia. It's your mourning her. You'll never mourn her. No, you don't mourn her. You won't mourn me. I mean, she makes fodder out of this conversation about Fulvia completely. But Fulvia is the offstage, this kind of Roman wife, the Roman wife who is like the Roman soldier, who is like the figure of Roman-ness, of a certain kind of the archetypal heroism. And then we get the other Roman wife, whom we actually do see, who is Octavia. And how would you contrast Octavia and Fulvia? Is Octavia at all like Fulvia?
Well, she seems to be powerless. Even in any decision she makes, it is hedged in by the viewpoint of her brother or her new husband. And she is unable to act almost without their approval.
Right. Thank you for framing it that way, because it reminds me of the opening scene of Othello, where we had Desdemona choosing between her duty to her husband and her duty to her father. And her, my fair warrior, as he then calls her and so forth, her active choice of the husband as contrasted with the father. In this case, Octavia is caught between a brother and a husband and really doesn't know how to choose between them. She is, unlike the absent, heroic, and dead Fulvia, not loved by Antony but admired by her, she seems very powerless. Her situation is that of wife rather than of soldier or of beloved. And the contrast between the message about Fulvia and her death and the story of Octavia and her dismissal was supposedly with a small train and so forth, and the way in which Octavius takes umbrage about the supposed behavior of Antony toward Octavia, when she herself has said, "I don't want a lot of attendants, so let's not make a big deal out of this." Her role is much diminished with respect both to that of Fulvia and that of Cleopatra, so that we get not only the binary of the two, the choice between these two women, but importantly this other dimension of what another kind of Roman wife might have been like, and therefore another kind of Roman-ness might have been like. The Roman wife of Antony in his prime, so to speak, was this martial wife as opposed to the Octavia figure. Yes, please.
I never know quite what of Cleopatra's flight in with her ships, but one might contrast, if it is a serious flight, one might contrast Fulvia's warlike behavior with Cleopatra's behavior.
Say just one more sentence about that.
Just that Fulvia is spoken of as a warrior to be admired. I mean, she's very strong,
right.
And
right.
She's right in there, and Cleopatra runs.
Right. Yeah. Well, and we also have that scene in which Cleopatra buckles on the armor of Antony, yeah. And it's a very disempowering moment, actually. You could think of Helen disarming great Hector in Troilus and Cressida. You could think of those other great Titanic figures who are obviously behind the scenes, or not so much behind the scenes in this play, that is the figures of Mars and Venus, whom this Antony and Cleopatra also much represent and would have represented to the Renaissance, where all those paintings, and we've talked about them, in which the god Mars has his armor off and he's lying sated from having had sex with Venus, and he's not doing what the god of war ought to do, that we have here in this play, again, that sense that somehow he is unmanned by his love for her, by his devotion to her, by his obsession with her, by his inability to, or unwillingness, really, to forswear that. He could do it. He's just not going to do it, ultimately. And it becomes a kind of choice on his part. He's not helpless. He actually keeps making choices. And the choice to follow her out of the battle is also a kind of choice, though it's described as the doting Mallard syndrome there. And that word dote is a word that I've talked about in here and that shows up throughout Shakespearean comedy in particular as a kind of sign word for being in love with love, for a kind of shallow kind of love. And it's voiced by Philo at the beginning of the play. Notice how many characters have names that look like love. We have Philo at the beginning of the play. We have Eros as the soldier that helps him to perform his Roman suicide. It's as if love is all over the play, whether you can recognize it or not. But Philo at the beginning of the play talks about the dotage of our general. And then we get the doting Mallard and so forth. It's not, and he uses that word himself. So he's able to perform that judgment upon himself, but not actually to act upon it. Yes, go ahead.
I know you want to look at some passages, but yes, before you do that, would you take a minute to explain why this is your favorite of all the plays?
Well, it's one hates to choose favorites. It's like, you know, choosing favorites among one's children or one's relatives or whatever it is. I do love the play. I think the language is absolutely gorgeous. I think the characters are fascinating in their complexity. For me, Cleopatra, of all of Shakespeare's female characters, is the most interesting and certainly the one I would most want myself to portray. If I mean, as contrasted with, say, Rosalind or Portia, or some of the more single-minded, self-assertive, strong women of the comedies, Cleopatra, in her perversity, seems to me to be an extremely interesting character. I think what we've been describing here about the human dilemma of this play is extraordinary. But I talk about it, I'm sure I do in my chapter as well, as a play that really is rather Baroque in its sensibilities, that it has a kind of grandiosity and a kind of twistedness and a kind of angularity about it that appeals to me very much aesthetically. All those long scenes in Act 4 and so forth. But it just seems to me to get everything right, that all the descriptions seem to me so powerfully right. When I took the play out this week again to look at it, and just got stopped by that first scene, which just keeps coming with more and more magnificent moments, and not only moments of language, to which I do want to turn, but also moments of staging. One of my favorite, of which I know I talk about in my chapter, when they say, you know, hush, here comes Antony. Not him, the queen, and where you see this reversal on the part the Romans expect, and Enobarbus expects, that Antony is going to be leading, because, of course, at the beginning of King Lear, you get all the kings and the dukes and so forth, and then the daughters. Here you have the queen, not Antony, and the play proceeds from there, that it's all about reversals and inversions. And I think it just never stops being good, that the death of Cleopatra, that so much high risk, so many high-risk moments in this play. The Boy My Greatness passage, her self-staged death, his suicide, his being pulled down from the monument, the staging moments of the play, as well as these fabulous language set pieces, I just think are irresistible. It's. I said to Larry, it's like eating lots of dark chocolate. It's just wonderfully, wonderfully rich. And it's not. It's never cheap. It's never, I think it never belies its own. It aims at something very high, and I think it really gets there. Does anybody share this view? Am I speaking against the grain here? Could I hear from somebody else about why they like this play? It would make me feel so good.
Yeah, I completely agree with you. I think it's a wonderful play. Well, not only you're talking about Cleopatra. I want to talk a little bit about Antony, and I think if you compare Antony with Troilus or Romeo. This is, to me, there is no comparison. Antony is so much more alive and human. It's like a real person to me. While I cannot say that same thing about Troilus or Romeo, for example.
So. Well, they are also in love with love. But they're rather petulant about it.
Yes.
And one of the wonderful things about Antony to me as a character is how much he embraces his own inconsistencies, his own weaknesses, his own age, his own self-disappointments. But I should say that I have had this feeling about this play, and one other that I'll mention in a moment, since I was a college student. That this is not, it's not as if I had my Romeo and Juliet phase and now I'm in my Antony and Cleopatra phase, but that I always felt a tremendous attraction toward the play and toward these major characters. And the other play that I want to say this about, because it's a play on our list, is The Winter's Tale, which I read for the first time as a college student and which I just was bowled over by, and I think you will be as well. Also, I was not, I hadn't had the experience of Antony and Cleopatra before I read it as a young adult, and I didn't expect it. And I was amazed by how much there was in it, whereas I thought I knew about Othello and I thought I knew about King Lear and so forth. Someone else, please.
I was blown away by how Cleopatra dies, and I personally get sick of the, oh, I am slain, dagger in the stomach kind of death. So when she pulls out the snakes, I was like, ooh, this is interesting. So,
right.
I mean, just to kind of throw that into the mix, I really thought
it's way over the top. It's really, I mean, that's partly what I mean by Baroque, that it takes these tremendous risks, that this is, you know, historical, it's archival, and so forth. But there it is on stage. And again, this could be completely bathetic. I mean, an actor or an actress who is not up to the basket and the asps and the see how they nurse me and so this not intrinsicate of life at once untied. I mean, it's a fabulous line, and this coinage, intrinsicate, which is intricate and intrinsic at the same time, seems to me the perfect word to describe the entire play, that it is completely intertwined with itself, that it tells the truth, which is what we might say about intrinsic here, but that it is also unbelievably intricate in the way it gets there. And that if we think of the play itself as being described in this phrase, this not intrinsicate, to me that's how the play works. And it's not as if it ever gets untied, like the Gordian knot. You look at the knot, and you see how impossible it is to pull one strand away from another, because what ultimately happens to these characters, and I talk about it again, I'm sure, in the chapter when I compare it to Shakespeare's wonderful lyric poem, the Phoenix and the Turtle, is that they create each other. The poem says, either was the other's mine, meaning both gold mine, but also others, each other. And that there's a sense in which the Antony and Cleopatra each makes the other. That's partly why we were talking in the interval about why they're not in so many scenes together. They keep missing each other and creating each other as metaphorical figures, as figures of fantasy and as figures of dream and of language. Larry, did you want to say something?
Yeah.
Please.
Actually wondering whether or not you might be able to speak about the genre of this play or about the problem of categorizing it generically. Because it seems to me, ever since I first read it, as sort of, you know, a profoundly genre-bending play. And I think that's sort of one of the things. I mean, I also have a deep love for The Winter's Tale, and that's sort of one of the things that I enjoy so much about that play. So I was wondering maybe if you could just comment on what we ought to do regarding genre, what we ought to think about the genre of this play.
Well, what dramatic genres do you detect in this play, or do you recognize or half recognize in it?
Tragedy, a little bit.
History. Tragedy, history. Comedy. Romance. What are the romance elements of this play?
The setting.
Beg pardon? The setting. Yes, the setting. Excellent. Okay. Absolutely. Anything could happen in Egypt. It's the overflowing Nile, for example, is a very good romance item. The sense that everything's happening at night, that it's, you know, an unbelievably sexualized landscape and household. Not every romance is like this, but these are romance-like categories, that the play is overflows the boundaries of genre in exactly this kind of way. And it does so, I mean, I'm going to get back to these passages, because it does so by juxtaposing these set-piece passages, one of which seems to come out of history, and one of which seems to come out of mythology, one of which seems to come out of romance. Her dream vision of Antony at the end of the play is pure romance, where he bestrid the ocean. When we talked about Julius Caesar before, and where you remember, those of you who know the play, where Cassius complains by why man he doth bestride the world like a colossus, and we petty men creep under his huge legs to seek ourselves dishonorable graves. Antony becomes that figure, that constellation at the end of the play, that her dream vision of Antony, which again is structured as a conversation. Well, let's look at it. This isn't where I'm going to start, but let's look at it. It's her conversation with Dolabella. In Act 5, Scene 2, about line 70, he comes in. Or he says, most noble empress, you have heard of me. I cannot tell, says Cleopatra. Are you with me here about 5'2", about 70? Assuredly, you know me. No matter, sir, what I've heard or known. Just love her. No matter, sir, what I've heard or known. You laugh when boys or women tell their dreams. Is it not your trick? Now, again, remember, this is a boy playing the part of a woman. The boys and women in this play are associated with that other world, that world of fantasy, of dream, of the unconscious, not the world of law and grid and Roman roads and so forth. And the implication here is that that world is devalued by the Roman world. You laugh when boys or women tell their dreams. Is it not your trick? Dolabella, I understand not, madam. And I want you to see why it's important that he should be a kind of straw man figure in this speech, that he's going to keep saying, I don't understand, I don't understand, that she's going to talk right past him at us, and that he is the figure of logic, rationality, good sense. It's not that he's not the clown. He's not someone who understands nothing. But she is talking about and embodying something which is way beyond him, and that is made clearer to us by his presence in the scene. So it's a little bit like that figure of Edgar that we saw in King Lear, where he says, you know, I would not take this from a poor, it is, and my heart breaks at it. I understand not, madam. I dreamt there was an Emperor Antony. Oh, such a sleep that I might see but such another man. And he doesn't want her to go on in this vein, so he tries to interrupt. If it might please ye. And then she's off and rolling. His face was as the heavens, and therein stuck a sun and moon which kept their course and lighted the little O, the earth. Again, remember that the little O is not only the earth, but also the wooden O, the globe here, that we have the sense of the theater. Most sovereign creature, again, he's trying to stop this flow. His legs bestrid the ocean. There he is, the Colossus. His reared arm crested the world. His voice was propertied as all the tuned spheres, and that to friends. But when he meant to quail and shake the orb, he was as rattling thunder. This is the passage we looked at the beginning of the term. Do you remember this? For his bounty there was no winter int, and autumn twas that grew the more by reaping. His delights were dolphin-like. They showed his back above the element they lived in. In his livery walked crowns and crownets. Realms and islands were as plates dropped from his pockets. Remember, we talked then about plates, about gold plate, and about money as plates. Cleopatra, he's getting closer and closer to interrupting her. Now the name is calling attention to her. Cleopatra, it's as if he's trying to wake her from a sleep. Think you there was or might be such a man as this I dreamt of? Gentle madam, no. And then he says, or she says, you lie up to the hearing of the gods. But if there be, nor ever were one such, it's past the size of dreaming. Nature wants such stuff, that lacks such stuff, to devise strange forms with fancy. Yet to imagine an Antony were nature's peace against fancy, condemning shadows white. So this is her triumph. This is her construction of Antony. Now if you'll go back with me to the beginning of the play, just to look at Octavius's Antony, and also at, who else is that I want to look at? Well, let's look at Octavius's first, in Act 1, Scene 4, line 60-something. Find it. Here we go. Yes. This is the speech that begins, Antony, leave thy lascivious wassails. So I want you first to, what kind of, when he begins the speech with Antony, what do we call that? An apostrophe. But notice he's not there. That this is again, spoken to the ether here. Antony, leave thy lascivious wassails. When thou once was beaten from Modena, where thou slewest Hirtius and Pansa, consuls at thy heel, did famine follow, whom thou foughtst against, though daintily brought up. You were brought up, you know, you were fed well, but now you're dealing with famine. Thou didst drink the stale of horses and the gilded puddle which beasts would cough at. Thy palate then did deign the roughest berry on the rudest hedge. Yea, like the stag when snow the pasture sheets, the barks of trees thou browsed. On the Alps it is reported thou didst eat strange flesh which some did die to look on. And all this, it wounds thine honor that I speak it now, was born so like a soldier that thy cheek so much as lanked not. So here we have it. The third passage that I wanted to point to was the passage that I began with, Philo's speech about what he was once like, but now he is in dotage. We have three different snapshots of Antony, all of them with him absent, and all of them parsing the kind of, because they're all right, they're all true. It's not as if one is false, but they're all a certain kind of fantasy. They're all a certain kind of cultural fantasy. As is Enobarbus' famous description of Cleopatra, where, again, I want you to notice that this is an as-told-you event. This really is an example of what I call a Shakespearean unseen, something that is brought to life as if we are there, though we are not. And this is Act 2, Scene 2, about line 200, where, again, the question is, what is she like? How could anybody be worth this? And Enobarbus, again, is in that position of the truth teller, the man who wants Antony to return, but understands that he will not. Never he will not, as we'll see. So here, as you know, is the passage that T.S. Eliot picks up and rewrites in The Wasteland to, again, show something of what has happened to this glorious image of transcendent erotic womanhood in the middle of the 20th century, when it's far more tawdry than it is here. This is a very close, as your footnotes will tell you, this is a very close transcription by Shakespeare of a passage in Plutarch, but looking at the difference between it and Plutarch will show you something of what Shakespeare can do as a poet. So what's being described is the scene when she first meets Antony. And with all of these love scenes, again, think about Troilus and Cressida, and when Troilus and Cressida first meet one another. Think, if you know it, about Romeo and Juliet and that moment when they first see each other and they speak a sonnet together and so forth. This scene of their first seeing each other is, again, removed. We do not see it. We only get it from retelling. One of the many, many extraordinary strengths of this play is that you never feel that people are merely making speeches. There are these long passages of poetry describing things that you don't see, but you don't feel as if it's a kind of closet drama in which they're merely kind of standing there and talking because they don't want to show you things. It's that this power of absence is at least as powerful as any presence, because what they're describing are erotic fantasies. The barge she sat in, like a burnished throne, burned on the water. The poop was beaten gold, purple the sails, and so perfumed that the winds were lovesick with them. The oars were silver, which to the tune of flutes kept stroke, and made the water which they beat to follow faster, as amorous of their stroke. So here we have this kind of soft sadomasochism of the beat me some more, the water adores her and wants anything. For her own person, it beggared all description. This is what's called in literature the indescribability topos. I can't possibly tell you how beautiful she was, which I'm now about to tell you. She did lie in her pavilion, cloth of gold of tissue, or picturing that Venus where we see the fancy outwork nature. So here again, inexpressibility, or picturing, more beautiful than Venus, even Venus, who, as fancy, looks better than nature, is as nothing compared to Cleopatra, who overpictures even Venus. On each side her stood pretty dimpled boys, like smiling cupids, with diverse colored fans, whose winds did seem to glow the delicate cheeks which they did cool, and what they undid did. And here again, you've got this onstage audience, Agrippa, who wanted to know, oh, rare for Antony. And I want you to compare this to the interjections of Dolabella, who kept saying no when Cleopatra was describing Antony. Here, Agrippa is saying, go on, go on. Enobarbus, her gentlewomen, like the Nereids, so many mermaids, tended her in the eyes and made their bends adornings. So again, the most menial gesture becomes homage here. At the helm, a seeming mermaid steers. The silken tackle swell with the touches of those flower-soft hands that yearly frame the office. From the barge, a strange invisible perfume hits the sense of the adjacent wharves. The city cast her people out upon her, and Antony, enthroned in the marketplace, did sit alone, whistling to the air, which, but for vacancy, had gone to gaze on Cleopatra too, and made a gap in nature. So nature abhors a vacuum, but even, you know, only the laws of physics make it the case that everything wasn't sucked out of this scene and rushing to adore Cleopatra. Rare Egyptian, says Agrippa. Upon her landing, Antony sent to her, invited her to supper. She replied it should be better he became her guest, which she entreated. Our courteous Antony, whom ne'er the word of no woman heard speak, being barbered 10 times o'er, goes to the feast, and for his ordinary pays his heart for what his eyes eat only. Royal wench, says Agrippa, and here's the voice of reality, she made great Caesar lay his sword to bed, he plowed her, and she cropped. So this is both the image of nature and the image of warfare here in this rather robust and profane image of Caesar making love to Cleopatra. But it also shows something about the fertility of Cleopatra, both in the natural world and in the fact that she did have children by Caesar. And notice here also in this image, this putting the sword aside, that the unmanning of the Roman hero, even with Caesar, happened. Of course, the sword is also here a phallic emblem, but the one kind of sword, as with Mars, is set aside so that the other kind of sword and the other kind of dying can take place. And now we have this little glimpse of the other Cleopatra. I saw her once hop 40 paces through the public street, and having lost her breath, she spoke and panted that she did make defect perfection and breathless poor breath force. So here is that, you know, the famous story about the oriental rug with the flaw in it that makes it more valuable. This is the human touch. Here's not the tragic flaw, but the erotic flaw, if you like. This is the aspect of Cleopatra that makes her irresistible, is not her breathtaking beauty, but the things that are slightly wrong with her. I saw her hop and pant out of breath. Now Antony must leave her utterly, says Maecenas, and Enobarbus, never, he will not. Age cannot wither her. So here's that age again. Nor custom stale her infinite variety. Other women cloy the appetites they feed, but she makes hungry where most she satisfies, for vilest things become themselves in her, that is to say, are becoming to her as well as come to maturation in her, that the holy priests bless her when she is riggish. And this paradox, supposed paradox, she makes hungry where most she satisfies, appears in a slightly different form in Romeo and Juliet, and is, in a way, a characteristic Shakespearean iteration of the appetite of love, that she makes hungry where most she's satisfied, that she is boundless, that the desire for her is without satiation. Yes, please.
I was just going to remark, it also sort of recalls her passage at the end describing Antony when she says, and autumn 'twas that grew more.
Thank you. That's great. That's absolutely right. And autumn 'twas that grew the more by reaping. So in both cases, and this boundlessness language does show up in Juliet's description of Romeo and of her as well, that in both cases the idea is that precisely by loving and by being, they continue to produce. And they produce that it's not as if love is ever really satisfiable, but the appetite for it is so profound that it animates these people. And when Enobarbus talks, and again, remember that Enobarbus is a Roman and is on the Roman side. And ultimately, what does happen to Enobarbus in this play? Why does he die? And why is his heart broken? He does this thing that he says Antony will not. He you know, makes the logical choice. He makes the rational choice. He makes the choice of the winning side, and he can't bear it. He can't, because, I mean, because all of these are love stories. All of these are love relationships. The relationship of Ina Barbus to Antony is a paradoxical love relationship. And paradoxical because he can see sees very clearly all his faults here, all his shortcomings. But he's very clear about this. He will not. Age cannot wither her, nor custom stale her infinite variety. That she's many women. That she, yes, please. Yes. Yeah, I think that's absolutely right, and it's not. I mean, there is a maturity about these figures, and overripeness even, and it's you see this back history that is painted of them. In Romeo and Juliet, we hear that he had Rosaline before he had Juliet as a love object, not as a lover, because Rosaline was so determinedly chaste. The Midsummer Night's Dream, we hear about all the loves of Theseus before he meets Hippolyta, who is his bride in Midsummer Night's Dream. But here it's different, because it's not as if this is the right one of those were the wrong ones. Quite to the contrary, that somehow learning to love and learning to desire has led to this point where they encounter figures who incarnate desire and who incarnate it in the paradox and the insatiability and the continual disappointments that make up for the erotic life here. So it's precisely in falling short that she satisfies him. It's precisely in being in making these indeterminate choices that he retains her interest.
They know themselves in a way that you don't see in these other love interests.
And this is the only place in Shakespeare where you really see this. I mean, I, having just spent some time with Macbeth and with this production of Macbeth, I can see how one might find those capacities in those characters. That there's also, but that's not what's developed because the plot is something else. But this really is a play about love and war, about age and youth, about possibility and impossibility, about dream and reality. And ultimately, it will not allow you to choose between those things as if they were exclusive things. Instead, it insists that you keep seeing that the vacillation, that the indecisiveness, that the deceptions, that the games, that these are not the things that stand in the way of love. These are the things that are love in this play, that is the maturity of the play, and I'm not going to map this onto Shakespeare's life in any way, but it seems to me to be deeply compelling as a narrative of the pleasures of the disappointments of love, and the necessity of over-idealization and over-realization. And the comic moments, let's talk a little bit more about the comic moments in the play because they're crucial to this play. What are some of the comic moments in this play? What about Lepidus, for example? Who is Lepidus? He's part of the triumvirate, yes. Could you say something about...
Isn't he the third ruler?
Yes.
Yeah, I mean, he gets quite drunk in one, one of the scenes where they make up the first time,
yes, exactly.
The three of them, and I guess I don't think he really plays a part in that, but it's they have the celebration dinner and he passes out, he drinks, and he
tells this the whole thing about the crocodile, what kind of a thing are you, a crocodile, and so forth, and then he passes out, and there's a little joke in which they say, who are you carrying? Oh, you're carrying the third part of the world, you must be very strong. Because so that you get this kind of mock heroism, but you also get this sense that, as any Shakespearean mathematics makes clear, that once we saw this in King Lear, once you start cutting the world up into pieces, it doesn't hold together. That the third part of the world is the sign that, and the realist in Octavius sees this very well, that he. That he needs to get rid of these rivals so as to reunify Rome. I mean, this is the only way that he can do it. And his that which he doesn't get, his abstemiousness, is part of what makes it possible for him to do it. I mean, again, we've got the drunken Lepidus and the extremely aggressively chaste Octavius here. Here you can think about Cassio. We can do kind of interesting essay about drunkenness in Shakespeare and what it reveals and what it conceals. But plainly, it's not part of an effective political world. One could think about Sir Toby Belch in Twelfth Night the same way, that the drunkenness militates against any kind of political efficaciousness. But the scene with all the kind of comic turns in the play, and this goes back to Larry's question about genre and the way in which the play really refuses to choose a genre, refuses to let you feel secure that you're in one. This is the moment of the Baroque, I think. I think that it's a kind of proto-tragicomedy in a certain kind of way. And that this is, to say it a slightly different way, many plays, many of Shakespeare's tragedies have been turned into operas. But this is surely the most operatic of all of Shakespeare's plays. It has long, triumphant passages. It has big scenery. It has big personalities. It's all about divas. There's something about it that will not be contained within the ordinary stage. And one of the things that won't be contained is the language of the play, which toward the end wants to talk about the whole world literally here as the stage. I'd like for us to, I want to do today what we were stopped from doing last time by the entry of the real world in the form of somebody else's exam, by looking at the last speech of the play. Because this is something that I've wanted to try to manifest to you every time we talk about one of these tragedies, that there's always a survivor. And the survivor, as we saw with Edgar or Albany, whoever you think speaks the last line in King Lear, and as we see with Malcolm in Macbeth, the survivor always fails to participate somehow in the tragic moment. So that we have the, Caesar, again, has in mind precisely that thing that Cleopatra says he has in mind and that he keeps disavowing, the fact that, and why? I mean, is it that he wants to bring her back in triumph as a trophy, as a Roman trophy? Absolutely. But what I feel very strongly about is that he also wants Cleopatra, that he, and they, all these other Roman heroes had Cleopatra, why not him? That having Cleopatra is for him, in a way, the sign of being a Roman hero, of being a Roman ruler, of being Caesar. And that she escapes his clutches at the end by this erotic act of self-undoing, and multiply, because his suicide is erotic enough, especially because it's performed by Eros, but hers with the asps and so forth, she is both mother and lover of these snakes. And he comes in too late, and she is dead. Sir, you're too sure an augurer, that you did fear is done, says Dolabella. Bravest at the last, she leveled at our purposes, and being royal, took her own way. The manner of their deaths, I do not see them bleed. Who was last with them? A simple countryman that brought her figs. And figs, of course, are erotic fruit in this period. So the Spanish gesture of fig for you is a obscene gesture. There's also a gesture of sexual intrusion here. Poisoned then. O Caesar, this Charmian lived but now. She stood and spake. I found her trimming up the diadem on her dead mistress. Tremblingly she stood, and on the sudden dropped. Remember that the soothsayer at the beginning of the play, that where they think he's telling the future, and indeed he is. He's just like the apparitions in Macbeth. He tells the truth, but it's not the whole truth. You're going to outlive your mistress, and she thinks she's going to live a long time, but in fact it's not so long. I love a long life better than figs. And here we've got the basket of figs here with the asp in it. If they had swallowed poison, it would appear by external swelling, but she looks like sleep as she would catch another Antony in her strong toil of grace. Now, toil is a net here. She looks like she's going to begin all over again. I am again for Sidonis to meet Mark Antony, is what she says as she dies. She wants to go back to that moment that we only have by the story that Ina Barbas tells us, the story that is in the real backstory, the real navel of the dream of this play here. Here on her breast, there's a vent of blood and something blown. The like is on her arm. So they're going to detect what it is because, again, they're realists and they want the real answer. This is an aspic's trail, and these fig leaves have slime upon them, such as the aspic leaves upon the caves of Nile. Most probable, said Caesar, and this is his last speech, that so she died, for her physician tells me she hath pursued conclusions infinite of easy ways to die. So here's a little, again, rationalization coming at the end. She's actually asked these questions before. Take up her bed and bear her women from the monument. She shall be buried by her Antony. No grave upon the earth shall clip in it, that is, embrace in it, a pair so famous. High events as these strike those that make them, and their story is no less in pity than his glory which brought them to be lamented. So here are those two genres again. The story of pity is Aristotelian tragedy. The story of glory is history. Our army shall in solemn show attend this funeral and then to Rome. Come, Dolabella, see high order in this great solemnity. And I break the lines there against their sense just to show you that the play again ends in a rhymed couplet, which is the traditional way of leaving the stage. But here we have a case in which he understands that he is excluded from this embrace. The grave embraces them. He yields to this moment in which the lovers, how interesting, Ariadne's thread comes toward me. There you go. One hardly knows what to say about this, but here's a moment of closure, which is also a moment of opening up. There are two closures here, the one on the stage and the one that he is envisages for them, in which the grave encloses them and they enclose each other. And they escape the play. And the moment of, and we come back to Larry's comment about the genres here, the moment of closure is also a moment in which those dreams and fantasies and projections outlive this nearly Roman moment at the end. So what's left is Octavius and Dolabella, who have established themselves as seekers after truth and seekers after power. But the story, the tragedy, the glory are all wrapped up together. And what we're left with, again, is the memory of these figures rather than their presence. We'll see with Coriolanus 2 weeks from now how a different kind of tragic self-awareness comes very late and very powerfully to another figure who, like Octavius, is described insistently in his adult heroism as a boy. So I'll see you in 2 weeks, and in the meantime, the exam you'll enjoy, I promise.